you all for being here. Just a little bit of a couple of odds and ends in terms of as we come towards the end of the course. Just to say that tomorrow I'm trying to step back from specific texts and take as thorough a look as possible about where the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Thomas have things in common, where they have things that are quite different, and give us time to assess a little bit what these two Gospels have to offer us, and where there might be some dangers in either of them. Also, a number of you have been wondering about a New Testament. We finally found the library copy, and it's back put on reserve over there. This is a book that I edited along with 19 other spiritual leaders in the United States. And what we did is we looked at 75 of the newly discovered texts, and then we added 10 to the New Testament. So that all of the texts of the traditional New Testament are there, plus the 10 that we added. I know that the bookstore is sold out, and I just want you to know,
Actually, we just bought one yesterday, and they had a bunch of copies, so I don't know if they are.
Oh, great.
That's more current, but yesterday they had a lot.
Oh, that's wonderful, because I had heard that 12 of them had sold out, and I thought they didn't have any. Oh, that's good.
I don't know.
Okay, thank you very much.
I'll go peek.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing to say is it is always helpful to support the bookstore here, but they're everywhere online. Amazon is selling them, and actually the Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, the publisher, has been very generous throughout its 5 years of publishing this, and they're really quite, even though it's a 600-page book, they've always sold it quite cheap. So, if you're looking for that.
Are all the lines that were added from Nag Hammadi, or the...
No, okay. No. So, for instance, the Gospel of Mary was the top vote getter, and it's not from Nag Hammadi. Well, I thought we might do just a little bit of devotional this morning. We've been working on so many other fronts that we haven't had a chance to learn how much devotional material is in the Gospel of Thomas. So I'm going to have us just look briefly at two texts in the Gospel of Thomas. If you would, to yourself, look first at 12 in the, excuse me, 10. 10, and then you can look at both 10 and 82. 10 and 82, and just read it to yourselves for a few moments. Yeah, these are two texts that are similar. We won't discuss it, we'll simply let it get inside us and have a few moments to use it devotionally. 10 and 82. If you don't have a copy of the whole Gospel of Thomas, there are copies here. Thank you. So just a way to be present to these two texts. You notice they're both about the fire, about fire. One in which Jesus says, I have cast fire upon the earth, and behold, I watch over it until it burns. And then 82, Jesus said, whoever is near me is near the fire, and whoever is far from me is far from the realm. So why don't we just notice for a few moments to ourselves where we're near the fire. That could mean whatever you want. Maybe the fire is comforting. Maybe the fire is dangerous. Just notice an experience of yours, either now or in the past, where you have felt the dangerous fire or the comforting fire, and think about it in terms of Jesus. No talk, just noticing. So just take a moment to own your experience of fire in your life. And take a moment to give to God, or wherever you want to give it, to give the experience of being near or in fire on in prayer. Thank you. So today we're going to look at a text that's in both Thomas and Luke, and we're going to need some help from the Gospel of Mark as well. And then we're going to get to what we were looking for yesterday. Yesterday I promised us some time with Luke, and Luke in terms of gender. On your handout, you also have a section on who is Jesus in Thomas and who is Jesus in Luke. We may or may not get there for more than 30 seconds. But let's look, if we can, on the handout. So on the front page, you have this a similar parable in Mark, Thomas, and Luke. And so I'll have us look at this. We're not sure whether Thomas's version or Mark's version is the earliest. But let's start at the top of the page with Mark. Just take a moment to read this parable in just Mark. Well, let's then, some of you have read this before. Some of you may not know that it's different in the three Gospels to a certain extent. But let's just, with Mark, let's see if we got the story and got Mark's take on it. Notice that, so this is a pretty typical situation in Israel of the first century, in which there is an owner of property, often a vineyard. Vineyard is often in the experience of the people of Israel, an experience of Israel itself. Vineyards are really important. So in this case, there's someone who owns the vineyard, but is that person working the vineyard? No. This is someone else is working the vineyard, and it's been, and they use it. And then, what's the relationship then of the work of those who are working the vineyard to the owner?
Tenant,
yeah. And what happens to the produce of the vineyard?
A portion goes to the owner.
A portion goes to the owner? And here, what we have as a story is a rebellion of the tenants, right?
Yeah.
The owner comes to get the produce that the owner claims off his property several times, finally sending his son to the vineyard, thinking he'll be respected. And what happened? Why? So they can have it all, right? So that's the end of the story. So scholars are really interested in the ends of many parables. Sometimes the ends of parables are the work not of Jesus, but of the author, Mark, in this case. So here you have basically just a little quote from the Mark and Jesus, right at the end. Have you ever heard the passage of Scripture? This is from the Hebrew Scriptures. The stone which the builders despised now itself has become the cornerstone. This corner has come from the Lord and is marvelous in our eyes. What do you think? How does this help one understand the revolt by the tenants and the murder of the son? This quote from the Hebrew Scriptures, how does it help us understand the story? Yeah.
Well, I think the revolt is not against the owner, because the owner is unknown, the owner is distant. And so it's the representative of the owner that they attack, because they're disconnected. And the cornerstone reference came right after it, saying, you're missing the point of the parable if you don't realize that something essential has been revolted against you.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Other meanings that you've heard of this, especially related to the last quote from the Hebrew Scriptures?
Well, my thinking is that Mark is saying that this is what's happening right now, that here is Jesus and you're rejecting, God the Father sends his son and you're rejecting this Jesus who is, like Sandy's saying, a cornerstone, very important. Mm-hmm. So he's interpreting this story with that final paragraph.
Thank you. I want to notice that I think that what Dan has just said is the primary understanding of the parable. That is, that it is, that this is actually not a parable, but an allegory. And an allegory in which the Jesus is the slain son. That would have some meaning in Mark, because Mark really is very interested in the meaning of Jesus' torture, that on the cross. I would want us to just sit, and I would say that I myself have seen this last quote as an interpretation of the story that makes sense to me in Mark. Now let's read Thomas. Remembering that there's a decent chance that Thomas is before Mark in its writing. So first, notice the first thing. Who owns the vineyard?
Usurer.
What's the status of usurers in Israel?
Not good.
Not good.
Not good because?
About squeezing profit out of people.
Yeah, you're not, the Torah says you're not allowed to get interest from anything for your profit. That would be also, by the way, our Bible. But so here, the person is identified as somebody who is breaking the Torah. By the way, just to keep you in front of everything, the Coptic word for usurer and the Coptic word for a good man is almost exactly the same. So you will find other translations of this text in which it says, a good man owned a vineyard.
Wow.
I know, it's scary. I and Celine Lilly, who did this translation, looked really carefully, and we have to say we're not sure of the Coptic, but we went for the usurer, partly because of other things we'll now see in the text. So how does this story end? How does this text end?
It ends with the rebellion, but there's no consequence.
Right, exactly. It's the rebellion, and the last sentence, the interpretive sentence is, whoever has ears to hear, hear. So the next thing I would want to remember is that in the larger history of Israel, one of the main things that the prophets hate in the name of God is the way the city people use their money to take the property of the peasants. The way Amos describes it is that there are people that are owning their own land, and often because Israel's land isn't all that good, their crop fails. And then they have to borrow money to stay in business. And this happens year after year, says Amos, until finally the people who've been owning the money in the city take the property, and the peasants lose it. And this is what Amos cries out against, as well as Jeremiah and Isaiah, by the way, cries out against the people of Israel for taking the land from the peasants. In other words, it is a common scriptural position that the people who own the land and are far away are condemned. So the fact that you don't have that interpretive stuff that we had in Mark at the end, which made us think about Jesus and the killing of Jesus, the killing of the Son being a bad thing, it's not in Mark. At least in this section of Mark. By the way, that is quoted in Mark as well. We can look at that. But
you mean Thomas.
Thomas, excuse me. Yeah. Sorry. So here, there's a possibility that Jesus is telling a parable about the successful and good reclaiming of the land by the peasant. So John Kloppenburg, a really famous scholar in Toronto, was the first to notice this about Thomas about 12 years ago. And he's written a really amazing book about it. And his work has convinced a bunch of us that this is actually what's going on in Thomas. This is a parable that takes the side of the dispossessed peasant. The other thing to say about parables is most parables of Jesus are simply stories that make you think. They're not allegories. So as we were saying yesterday, parables are tricky stories that surprise you. So what Mark is doing at the end of this story is turning it into an allegory. An allegory is where, in a story, every piece of the story has a secret meaning. And so, in other words, it's not really about the tenets, it's really about Jesus' death on the cross. That would be highly unusual, that a parable would turn itself into an allegory. I would say, by and large, that's just an allegory. It's not a parable. Parables are always funny, interesting, tricky stories. Remember, when the realm of God is compared to a mustard seed? So everybody who's reading it in the first century is laughing at that, because mustard is a weed. And so that's a comparison of the realm of God to a weed growing wildly. Now, let's just leave that hanging. Very well, I hope we're nervous by now. And then look at Luke's version. Now, the first thing I have to say is this is just the parable in Luke, but you need to know that in Luke, there's two previous stories right before this in which the chief priests and Pharisees are accosting Jesus because he's teaching dangerous things. They say, "What authority do you have to teach this stuff?" And Jesus says, "Well, what authority do you have to teach this stuff?" And then Jesus tells this story. In Luke, you have a story in back of the telling of the story that brings it meaning. And it's basically the same story, except look at what I think is somewhat garbled end to the story. Let's pick up on, I'm picking up where the end of the story is ending. What will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyards to others. When they heard this, they said, "God forbid." Now here's the question, who is they? is this in the story, or is this the Pharisees and chief priests who are arguing with Jesus? I think we actually find that out because look at the very end. The scribes and chief priests tried to lay hands on Jesus at that very hour, for they feared the people, for they perceived that he, I think this is Jesus, had told this parable against them. So it looks like, and again, it's really garbled here. We can't know for sure who the he is in both cases. It looks like when the people say, God forbid, after Jesus in the story says, he will come, the owner will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others, then it's the chief priests and scribes who say, God forbid, that's not going to happen. In other words, in the argument back and forth, they are so scared and mad at Jesus that they're saying, that story can't end that way. Mainly because they feel like he's saying, you are the are the owner who's coming back and taking and punishing the tenants and giving it to someone else. So here, for instance, of course, he will destroy the tenants. So here it's quite clear that not only does the owner come back, but the owner comes back and probably kills them. So now we got a lot of killing going on in the story, right? So then the hearers of Jesus say, wait a minute, it can't end that way, because they think that this story is aimed at them as doing the same thing to the poor people. Now then also look further. Now then we have the same quote from the Old Testament as we did in Mark. Everyone who falls on, when this is, then Jesus, I think it's Jesus, looked at them, I think that's the Pharisees, or the scribes, and said, what then is written? The very stone which the builders rejected has become the head of the corner. Everyone, my typo here, who falls on that stone will be broken in pieces. But when it falls on anyone, it will crush them. So this is a different reading of the meaning of the stone rejected. At first I thought, I can make no sense of Luke in what Luke is doing with that. But it's the more I think about it, I've been going over and over again the Old Testament text, the very stone which the builders rejected has become the head of the corner. Everyone on, and then Jesus' interpretation, the Luke and Jesus, everyone who falls on that stone will be broken in pieces, and when it falls on anyone, it will crush them. This makes me want to think that this is not about Jesus the Son being killed, but this is about, in other words, the stone rejected there are the peasants. It seems to me to be a real possibility. And then I went back to Mark, and I thought, maybe the long history of allegorizing this story in Mark actually was one of two. Maybe Mark also sees the rejected stone as the peasants. So I've been teaching for about 5 years that this is the place where Thomas and Mark and Luke disagree that Thomas is the only revolutionary one. But I'm now thinking that Thomas is just the clearest endorsement of the tenets. And that it seems like there's a decent chance that both Mark and Luke also have a similar read. I'm obviously not sure of myself. Yes.
I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about why the God forbid would refer to them seeing themselves as the ones who destroy the tenets rather than them seeing themselves as the tenets.
Yeah. Well, thank you. So the temple not only does Rome tax the peasants, the temple has, in that time, very rarely, but in that time, the Jerusalem temple, which is controlled by Rome, has started taxing the peasants.
I'm curious to know why you would choose a political interpretation of this when Christ's messages consistently go beyond political. And it strikes me that this is a political issue rather in the way that you've interpreted it.
I'm following John Kloppenborg and Thomas and now being messed up by the fact that it looks like Mark and Luke may have a similar question. So I would say in general, the teachings of Jesus seem to be both political and non-political. So there are some times...
How does that jive with the coin?
The coin is an evasion. So I guess I remember Jesus, they tried to trap Jesus, whose it is, and Jesus basically doesn't take a stand on whether you're taxed or not. Whether you should be taxed or not, he simply gives a clever answer that says, "Give to Caesar what's Caesar, and God what's God."
I'm not sure that interpretation gives Jesus the benefit of the truth beyond that. To call it an evasion, it's clever, but it also reveals a truth. And consistently, he was speaking more of the relationship with the Creator, God, than ever with political power.
Yeah, thank you. I think this is really important to think through. I think then in the story about Jesus and whether you should pay taxes to the emperor. If I understand what you're saying, Jesus is saying yes.
Yeah.
I'm just mostly following my mentors, who say that is the opinion of powerful Christians. I would tend to agree with most of my mentors on that. That this seems to be, when people ask him, should we pay taxes to Rome? The tension in that story is so deep because all of the people listening know how terrible the taxes are hurting people, and so. That Jesus actually doesn't say yes, pay taxes, or no, don't pay taxes. Jesus is simply evasive. So that's just where I got my stuff. And I think that what you're saying is the way I was raised. I would say, your point is really helpful. Jesus is not always political. And trying to read Jesus politically all the time would be an error.
Okay. It seems to me that really drives down to the apostles' confusion about Christ's role as Messiah. They were aimed that the apostles themselves wanted a political leader.
Mm-hmm.
And Christ over and over made it clear that he is a leader spiritually. He is not a political leader. So for that reason, I would be confused if his intention was to encourage a rebellion politically, which is what this implies.
Yeah, I think that's really an important point. The my kind would say that that's what Jesus was killed for.
Mm-hmm.
The only way you get crucified is because you're leading a revolt, according to Roman rule. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I'm glad both of our perspectives are out there.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Sure.
I'm wondering if you can enlighten me in Mark and Luke. They think that killing the heir will give them the inheritance.
Yeah, right? in Thomas too. Yeah.
Well, I don't see it that clearly in Thomas.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't really say that. It says they killed him, but they don't make an allusion that they're going to get the inheritance. So I'm curious about why in Mark and Luke they think they would get the inheritance. Like what slave would get the inheritance from the owner? Like, was there a law at this time?
No.
Like, how would they even think that they would get the inheritance?
This is theft. This is murder and theft.
Yeah.
And by people who have been themselves hurt.
Right. And in the big, in that big world, would they really get the inheritance?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Especially since in one of these versions, the guy lives really far away.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But
so he's gone.
So he's gone, and we're
harvesting.
And
Rome hardly ever cares about this, and the local government isn't.
They're not watching really carefully. But Thomas doesn't talk. He just simply kills him.
Yeah, I probably am reading into it when it says, since they knew he was the heir, they seized him and killed him. But you're right, that's not the same as in Matthew, or in Mark and Luke.
Another way of thinking about it would be, since he is the heir, we kill him, no one else is going to ask anymore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that's how you inherit it, because no one's bothering.
Yeah, and again, the absentee character of the ownership is key to the trick in the story.
The trick, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So both Mark and Luke have that. What will the owner do? He will come. He will come and destroy them and give it to the other, give it to each others. And that's not in Thomas. In Mark, if it just ended there, without the reference to the Hebrew scriptures, it would sound to me kind of like that was the moral of the story, if you will. You know that of course, if you're going to behave this way, that's what's going to happen to you. The owner's going to come and destroy you and give it to others. And so it would seem that it's taking the side, or that it's pointing out the bad behavior of the tenants. That may kind of be complicated by the reference to the cornerstone. I don't know if I know what to make of that. But that seems like a more clear reading in a way.
Yeah.
In Luke, there's also a line, he sent another slave, him also they beat and treated shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. And just in trying to get the feeling of it, I'm wondering how in the original language to interpret that word shamefully, because it could mean that their behavior and how they treated the slave was shameful, so the shame is upon the tenants. Or it could be that they're treating him in a way that puts shame upon the slave. You know, that I'm not sure what the slave loses face by being treated that way, if you will. In which case, it doesn't really cast any moral aspersion on the tenants. I just wonder what's the better way to read that.
Yeah, let me give to both things just quickly. So I agree with you that if the readership of this is middle-class people who own property, that's what we would see. But, I mean, literally, Amos, when he treats the same situation, says, God's going to kill you, Israel, for doing this. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, I think it depends on who's reading it, and I think middle-class Christians have been reading it for hundreds of years, and that's the natural thing that they would think. Now, shamefully, I think that's a good question. I would just add one possibility to what you're saying, that there are many texts in which when there's someone beaten, the word shame is added, and that means they raped him. So, in other words, this is common in Roman behavior. For instance, all soldiers, when they win a battle, when a Roman soldier wins a battle and finds a defeated soldier, he is ordered to rape him.
Oh, it's happening in Africa right now.
In other words, so this is common Roman behavior. And the main problem, the main issue there is not to take some kind of sexual pleasure, but to shame them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anyway, three choices rather than two. I love all these questions. We're going to get these two and then maybe try to get to gender and the other. Yes, go, please.
Yeah, well, I don't want to distract you.
That is not a distraction.
I guess I want to, more with the Mark and Luke interpretations than Thomas's, so that's a little more straightforward. Is it possible that no matter the readership, kind of no one wins in this situation? The owner loses his vineyard, his heir. The tenants lose their lives. It seems like in both parables it could be cautionary to whoever is hearing the story.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yes, there are scholars who say exactly that. That this is neither, but saying the level of violence is eating us out.
Mm-hmm. The fire.
Jim.
I just pointing something out, kind of like the whole, in Thomas, it doesn't directly imply that the tenants will get the thing. Thomas also does not say that the owner is distant or goes away.
No, and Thomas says maybe he's the usurer. It's.
I mean, he could be right down the road. In Thomas's version, there's just nothing about him leaving it. So it's interesting how, to allegorize it, Mark and Luke add that detail so that you get this sense of, oh, God's kind of like that. God has gone away or is distant.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. And Mark, if the translation of the Coptic is correct, Mark starts up front by saying, this is a bad guy because he's a usurer. I would say there is there are implications in all three that you may want to see the owner as bad, but I think that's not clear.
But similar to the parable of the talents, right? We always we look at that as maybe that's not a good guy. It changes the whole thing.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So okay. So I apologize. I'm really excited the level of interpretation you all are jumping into, and to see how wonderfully complicated and interesting adding Thomas into the mix is. So in other words, and this makes especially since Thomas is shorter and has less additional scripture on top of it. There's a real interesting chance that this is the best version. I mean, the earliest, the closest to Jesus' version. Yes?
I haven't been in all of the classes, so I can't I apologize for anything that might be repetitive, but what responsibility do you feel as an interpreter to harmonize your interpretation with other elements of Christ's message? For example, the Beatitudes. How do they fit with an interpretation that affirms the role that these tenets play? If loving your neighbor as yourself, that sort of, that theme, which is consistent throughout the gospel, is not affirmed in positive regard for the way they treated someone.
See, this is happening so much in the last three classes. They're all jumping in and really working hard on this.
Yeah.
That we can't not ask your question.
Okay.
And so I'm going to stay even longer with it for a moment. Just my opinion is that the Gospels are not all the same in their opinions on many issues. So what you are saying is really important, but one has to ask the level that at the level of the particular gospel. So in other words, one has to understand what the voice of the gospel writer, her or himself, is. You have to ask the big question that you're saying about the whole story.
And the way all of these stories weave together.
That's where I would have another opinion. As one of the things we've been saying all week long is there's great evidence in the second century, especially of the conservative interpreters in the second century, that one claimed the Gospels as diverse and different. So Irenaeus says the reason you need four Gospels is because there are four winds that blow and four corners of the earth. That's a weird thing to say, but what it means is the great thing about four Gospels is you have four different winds. So, in other words, and I think then in the second century, the reason that you are trying to pile up a bunch of different things is not because they're all, for instance, in order, in line with the creed or something like that, or they're all together. It's because everybody's experiences are different. And so some people will want to read Luke because it's closer to their life. Some people will want to read Thomas because it's closer to their different life. Okay, thank you so much. I'm going to do, now turn over, no, it's at the bottom of the page. And, so this is wanting to think more about gender in both of these Gospels. I'm going to emphasize Luke. Because as we said just briefly yesterday, Luke has been stunning for scholarship in the last 30 years in discovering how much gender is a hot topic in the first century. So here, what I said, and you can take this home, it'll really help, I think. In Luke, there are simply more women than in Mark, which comes first. So, for instance, we see there are really a total of 18, and then I've given you 13 on the other page. When you look at where there's a story of a man, Luke in at least 18 different places adds a woman, either to sayings. So you see on the other side. Let me look down at 8:40. There's a story of Jesus heals Jairus' daughter. In Luke, Jesus heals a hemorrhaging woman. So in other words, what you see is Luke adding women into the story. I can't read that otherwise than to say Luke wants to highlight women's leadership and women's participation. And Luke is doing it massively. So as I said to you all yesterday, just briefly, in the 1980s was when feminist scholars discovered this about Luke. And we were all so excited, we even started saying, maybe Luke is her. And we then threw ourselves into, we thought, okay, well, we found this, let's look more about women in Luke. So in the 1990s, there were all kinds of great studies, more about what's Luke doing with women. So first I want to say, those 1990 studies always affirmed the 1980s studies, and that meant Luke is clearly intentionally adding women to the story to undermine the importance of women.
To what?
The importance of women.
He's adding these stories to undermine the importance of women.
To underline. Underline the stories of women. Now,
women have to show.
That would be a really bad misstatement for me.
That's what Hal said.
So now, look down in the middle of the back page to what we found out about more things that happened to women in Luke. Assertive women are not highlighted in Luke. So, for instance, Mark has this great story of the Syrophoenician woman. You remember that? So she wants her daughter heated. Jesus calls her a dog and says, I don't treat dogs, I just treat children, because she is a foreign woman. Dog, of course, is even in our language an insult to a woman, the B word. And dog is also an insult in the first century to foreigners. So when Jesus says, I don't deal with dogs, I deal with children, and I can't heal your children, your child, the woman stands up and says back to him, but you know, at least dogs get the crumbs. And she talks Jesus into healing her daughter. Right? That's Mark. Guess where Luke places this? Luke leaves it out. Similarly, only in Luke we have the story of Martha and Mary. And remember how there Jesus comes to their house for a meal, and Martha's running around getting everything ready. Mary is sitting at Jesus' feet learning. No other gospel has this story. The problem about, there's a number of problems about this story, of course. One is that Jesus corrects the woman in charge. Secondly, Mary, who Jesus compliments, is silent and kneeling at Jesus's feet, or sitting at Jesus' feet. You need to say in the etiquette of meals where Jesus teaches, which is the case, everyone is reclining to emphasize that, and that there are lots of stories in which women are reclining alongside of men as Jesus is teaching. But the sign of subservience, since the sign of equality is everybody reclines, the sign of subservience is to sit. So Mary, in this text, is not reclining to listen to Jesus, but taking the subservient position of sitting. So, in other words, I'm afraid that, I mean, and a lot of people like this story in Luke about the two women. And a lot of people are kind of mixed up, or I see a couple of women shaking their heads against it right now.
Say that again. You said she's not reclining, but she's sitting?
Yeah.
And that's absurd.
And that's what you do when you have to, that's a sign that you're not equal. Everybody reclining is a sign of equal.
Because they're relaxed.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
So, where are you going with this?
I'm halfway through my list. Yes, ma'am, over here before I go on.
Oh, I was just going to say, well, if she's sitting and Martha is serving, well, then what does it say about her status?
Whose?
Martha's.
It says that Jesus yelled at her.
What your question is because she's serving, that would be a subservient function?
It is true to a certain extent, but she's also acting like the boss of the house.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to go on to what we found out about Luke that was a little scary in addition to Luke adding women. Men speak in order to help women. Men speak in order to help women in 8:43, and a woman is hidden in the crowd in 8:48. These are only in Luke. A man speaks for the woman in 8:43, and a woman is hidden in the crowd in 8:48. Further. A woman raises her voice, blessed to Jesus, this is only in Luke, who bore you. And Jesus responds, more blessed are those who hear God's word and keep it. In other words, Jesus is not taking the woman seriously. No woman speaks at Jesus' death or at the grave in Luke. They do speak in Mark and Matthew, but that, and it's almost certain that Luke knows Mark. So Luke has taken away the agency of those women from the text itself. So this is the same author who adds women. So in other words, all of us in the 1980s were so happy about maybe Luke is even a woman and it's really a strong push for women's equality. That's all right. But what we've now found when we looked more carefully is Luke also undermines women's authority. So what to make of that? Most feminists now say you have to affirm both. And that this means that what is going on in the writing of Luke is the enacting of controversy in Luke's group as to how much women deserve authority. And the answer is yes and no, or some and none, or much and little.
Right.
Yeah, so in other words, it's so important to see how Luke adds women. And it turns out it's probably important to not trust it completely.
I feel really affirmed by what you're saying, just because I remember late 90s in seminary writing a paper and comparing women in Luke and women in John, and just coming to the realization of something. Oh my gosh, Luke silences women all over.
Right.
Besides the Magnificat, which really stands out.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Luke silences women all over the place.
Yeah,
women. And then in John, it's all about outspoken women having conversations with Jesus and arguing back and forth.
So I've messed up time management again. but just to refer you to, if you want to read about comparing and contrasting who Jesus is in Luke and Thomas, read the bottom little piece. And tomorrow we're going to finish all the questions and it'll all be rounded up perfectly. Thanks so much.